Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Ashley McBride? Y'all like Ashley? Originally from Mammon Springs, Arkansas, Nashville-based singer-songwriter Ashley McBride has opened for Beth Hart, Johnny Lee and the Urban Cowboys, and Point of Grace, just to name a few. She has hosted her own round at the prestigious Bluebird Cafe and can be seen playing around Nashville at the Commodore Grill and Cadillac Ranch. Ashley is currently playing regular shows in Arkansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Tennessee to promote her new album. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at ashleymcbride.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Doug Norton, and our featured piece is this painting here, entitled Elvis, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's stories are all centered around our writers encountering a twist of fate. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Judy Goss thinks it's the end, but fate has something else in store. And we'll end the night with Brian Irwin and a turn he never saw coming. But let's start the night with Bruce Snow, an infamous storm, and a special dog who found his way back home in Foul Weather Friend.
In August 2005, my grandparents were in Florida visiting their youngest daughter while I, my disabled mother, my uncle, and his wife held down the fort at the family home on Mandeville Street in the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans. We entertained the idea of evacuating as we watched the massive storm fill the Gulf of Mexico, but in the end, decided that it was our duty to stay with the house and protect our home, the legacy of success achieved by two young immigrants who came from Ecuador, penniless, in the early 60s. No hurricane had ever caused much trouble for us before, so we agreed to ride it out. Little did we know that this hurricane would be different. This was Katrina. The electricity went out and the wind howled. The rain came down in blinding sheets as we huddled in the narrow hallway for protection. Everyone was frightened, including my little dog, Dolja. I first met Dolja 3 months before my 18th birthday. Found wandering the streets, he made a pitiful sight. Small and black with short hair, he had a long tail and a browned around his muzzle. A little guy, part miniature pincher and rat terrier. He was completely afraid. I'd never met a dog who was so scared of people. If you stood over him to lean down to pet him, he would cower down and shake and shiver. Wherever he'd come from, he wasn't treated kindly. It broke my heart. I had taken him home, given him a bath, and named him Dolja. And now Katrina was bearing down on us. I held him close to me, and we both trembled together. The sound the wind made was like ghosts passing through your soul. There wasn't much else to think about except your own mortality. And it was too loud for any distracting conversation anyway. The mind was pinned down by the sound. After about 3 hours of this torment, the rain slackened and stopped. The wind still howled fiercely, but without the rain lashing out, becoming its voice, it too became less frightening. My uncle and I decided to go outside for a quick look around. I'd been cradling Dolja for hours now. His warmth and his soft fur were comforting to stroke, though he wasn't comfortable at all. I passed him to my mother to hold, and we set out. What we saw gave little reassurance. Down trees and limbs, and nearly every awning on every house blown away. But that wasn't the worst of it. We saw the water. Unknown to us at the time, the London Avenue Canal had broken its levees less than a mile from our home. Instead of water draining, it was gushing out of every storm drain and manhole in sight. In less than 3 hours, the exterior steps, which connected the main house to my apartment, were submerged. And though we tried to barricade the doorways, the old hardwood floors proved no match for the rising tide. We grabbed what we could from the kitchen, grabbed the dog, and retreated to the attic. The wind still howled fiercely, and we were defeated. We had little food, and all of the water containers we'd filled in the bathtub, well, they were underwater now, too. I climbed out of the attic window, which leads to the roof, and watched the sunset on my submerged neighborhood alone. The next day, we were freed from our roof by neighbors we'd never met, wandering by on a fishing boat. I cut a line of phone cord running through the attic and made Dolja an impromptu leash. My mother was recovering from a hysterectomy and gamma knife surgery for a benign brain tumor. All of her medication was underwater. She assured us she was strong enough to make the roughly 6 mile hike to the Superdome, where food, water, and medical services would await us. We began our march up Elysian Fields Avenue to get to Interstate 610, the quickest way to the stadium. You could live your entire life in the city of New Orleans and never realize just how the ground slopes. We started off in water only ankle deep, not so bad. Picked up the dog and kept going. Then our knees were under, to the waist. Finally, when the water was up to our shoulders, we stopped. There were two more blocks to the interstate ramp, and I was balancing a squirming little black mutt on the crown of my head. Once again, we were rescued by people in a boat, New Orleans police this time. We reached the highway and started trekking for the Superdome. Unsurprisingly, there was a long line to get in. Bags were being checked for weapons and drugs, etc. The young National Guardsman who began to look us over said we were okay, but the dog couldn't come in. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I tied the end of his phone cord to a piece of barricade set out with other unhappy animals tied to it. I hugged Dolja and told him I loved him. I was sorry, but we had to go. The men said SPCA personnel were en route to see to the animals, and when this thing cleared up, I vowed to find him, to bring him home no matter what. The other animals, dogs and cats tied to the barricade, all looked crazed and dazed and were chewing at their tethers, trying to free themselves. I looked at my own and knew I was feeding him and myself a bowl full of foul-tasting lies. My mother volunteered to wait outside with him, but we dragged her in with us while he shrieked with fear as we walked away. I didn't look back. Once inside, it didn't take long before my mother slowed her pace as we ascended bank after bank of stairs. I turned around and she was gone. 20 minutes later, she reappeared with Dolja cradled in her arms. She didn't really explain how she did it, and I was too grateful to ask. The next morning, I shared one of the most memorable breakfasts I'll certainly ever have in my life with my little black dog on the field of the Superdome at the 40-yard line, huddled underneath the opposing team's benches. We ate bread and peanut butter from an MRE, and he drank water from my cupped hand. In a week, we were in Florida with my aunt and grandparents, still trying to wash off the grime from those long days in late August and early September. Years would pass, and Dolja moved to South Texas with my mom and my beautiful grandparents. The prospect of rebuilding just seemed like too much for them and their memories. I found myself in Little Rock, Arkansas, in love and engaged to be married. The wedding was scheduled for December 1st, 2010, and to my delight, Dolja would be making the trip. When I saw him, I couldn't believe my eyes. He was old now, over 13 years. He had trouble walking and seemed to be almost totally blind. My mother told me he'd had what she thought was a stroke a few months ago and hadn't told me because she didn't want to upset me. He would just lie in a heap on the carpet and breathe painfully. I laid down next to him and petted my old friend. Despite his pain and all of the strength it must have taken, he raised himself up, came to me, and began to sniff. I hadn't seen him but maybe a couple of days in 5 years, but he remembered me. He sniffed me and pressed himself against me and licked the hand he'd lapped water from on the artificial turf of his football stadium years before. He died 4 days later on Christmas Eve. And though it tore me apart inside, I felt a definite sense of pride that it was me who had rescued him from a life of fear and probable death as a stray pup, who'd carried him through the turgid waters of our flooded city and held him while he was still warm after he'd died. That it was me who had the honor of burying him hundreds of miles from our respective homes in the rain on Christmas morning. That Christmas, I wrapped and delivered a present I will truly never forget.
When he isn't driving a streetcar through Argenta in downtown Little Rock, New Orleans native Bruce Snow can be found reading, writing, and playing music with his band, Mutations of Thursday. He lives in Sherwood, Arkansas with his wife, daughter, and a menagerie of beloved critters. Next, Judy B. Goss and her daughters discover that sometimes tempting fate can be a slippery slope in The Fish Story.
On that fall day in 1984, when I arrived in front of Forest Park Elementary before school was out to take my 6-year-old daughter Jamie to her piano lesson, I wasn't looking for trouble. She and Margie, who was then 2, had survived many minor mishaps, so I felt no portent of danger under the gray sky. I do remember the familiar anxiety of trying to beat the clock. So many errands to run, items to bring along, and tasks to complete, all on time. 30 years earlier, my mother had left the car in drive at the cleaners, subjecting me and my sister to a terrifying roll until she jumped screaming back into the Chevy. As I now tell the story, I realize there should have been at least an intuitive shiver because I, too, was driving a Chevy that day. I loved our sporty Citation, although the 2-door model wasn't ideal for carting kids around. It was always a minor aggravation to push the seat latch, swing the driver's seat back, hold it with my derriere while leaning forward to either strap Margie in or lift her out of whatever booster seat was required back in those dark ages. After countless repetitions, I had the movements down pat, and Margie and I were running pretty close to schedule as we entered the school that afternoon. I signed in at the front desk, traded pleasantries with Forest Park's sociable secretary, Pat Lusby, and headed for Mrs. Stansel's first grade room. Jamie was ready to go, but had more than a handful of things to carry. She shoved her jar with the 2 goldfish from the Halloween carnival, which she had shared for show and tell, into my free hand. I balanced Margie on my hip with the other arm. So off we went, and after I opened the school door with another of my derriere moves, we clipped down the sidewalk to the car. Jamie hopped into the passenger's bucket seat in front, where I'd also placed her piano music bag, and I got Margie buckled down in record time. The next challenge was to drive a lap around the block following the one-way street patterns that encircle the school, stopping at each corner sign, of course. Since I couldn't really speed, the fish jar didn't go sailing with a crash into the street until our third stop. In a flash, I envisioned the miracle of the jar staying positioned atop the car until that horrific instant. As I shouted, "Jamie, She screamed, "Mom, you killed my fish!" It was not from optimism, but from the burden of being the eldest sibling, always responsible, that I swerved to the right, away from the direction in which centrifugal force had flung the jar, and gunned the car back to the school's entrance. It was my habit to have a glass of water in the console cup holder, and fish needed water desperately. I raced inside the building to the restroom near the entrance, where I filled the glass, grabbed a fistful of brown paper towels. There would be shards of glass and maybe squished fish on the pavement. I hadn't the courage to look at the moment of impact. Thus armed, I jumped in the car and again negotiated the one-way course, perhaps rolling through stops one and two. As I approached stop three, sudden dread forced me to hang my head out the window like a teenaged cruiser. What if I ran over the living fish now? My heart raced, but I slowed the car to a crawl before stopping. Oh, yes, two whole fish lay in the street, as still as a painting, no surprise, but worth grabbing. Leaping from the car, I scooped them up and hastily dropped them into the glass. I ran back to gather what broken shards I could spot in the street, quickly placed the wad of paper and glass in the floor of my back seat. We were finally on our way to the piano lesson. The gloomy gray clouds threatened rain, and I still had to cross Cantrell Road's afternoon traffic at yet another stop sign. To lift the gloom that had penetrated the car, I said, "Jamie, watch the glass, and maybe the fish will move." I heard a soft, "Okay," as I gripped the wheel, looked back and forth eagerly for the chance to dart across to the quieter Heights streets. We were really late to piano, and I'd feel doubly awful when Mrs. Long greeted us with her radiant smile anyway. Finally, an opening. We zipped across Cantrell, and at Kavanaugh, I took my late grandfather's traffic tip, always turn right rather than stop. After the two left turns it took to correct our course toward the final box, Jamie shouted, "It's alive! It's alive!" Discounting the word "it's," and sticking to my first task, controlling the car with eyes on the road, I replied, "Really, Jamie? Really?" "Yes," she cheered. As we came to the last stop sign, I glanced down and I could see one of the fish wiggling enough to be visible, even though he was swimming under the body of his buddy, which had floated to the top of the glass. "Jamie, this is a miracle," I exclaimed as we approached Mrs. Long's house. "I'm going straight to the pet store and getting a bowl for this very special fish." I hurried Jamie up to Mrs. Long's door and greeted her with apologies mixed with joy over the resurrected fish. The rain held off until my mission and the piano lesson were finished and we were home again. For the next 2 years, I fed the fish, cleaned the bowl, and walked past it enough in our sunny den that whenever I entered the room, it would swim to greet me, wiggling, "Hello!" My daughters can vouch for the fact. As I told our fish tale, people admitted flushing such free goldfish down the toilet after their kids won them at similar school or church events. Well, I did send our fish's dead pal down the toilet on that fateful day, but I never could have flushed our gold miracle. I sold it at a garage sale. I was delighted to provide a grandfather with a fine bargain, bowl, fish, obviously healthy and happy, and food for next to nothing. He was tickled with the surprise he'd take to his grandson. As the story finally ended, I saw it wasn't about the fish for Jamie, and even for Margie, who didn't utter a sound the day the jar flew off the car because any drama drew her full attention. It was about how I could make such a crazy mistake and what on earth I could do about it. I knew I was bound to create more goofy calamities and then scramble to fix them. I also knew I'd be the protagonist of many cautionary tales in the Goss family lore, which would be used to tease, prod, remind, and protect each other as we bumble through the years. My mother failed to put the car in park more than once. And although I didn't kill another goldfish, there was the time I backed out of the driveway in a rush to the Kamak pool with a giant shark floaty blocking my rearview mirror and hit, oh well, that's a different story.
Yeah. Judy B. Goss attended Sewanee Writers Conference Playwrights Workshops 3 times and produced her play First Farewell at Argento Community Theater here in North Little Rock. This fall, Hendricks College will present her children's script, Lost My Shoe to a Wallaroo. In our final story of the night, Brian Irwin's entanglement with fate takes a sinister turn in After School Special.
I command you in the name of Jesus to come out of this boy and leave him. I was kneeling to Mrs. Pascal's right, my eyes shut tight, peeking occasionally as one does when watching a scary movie. Cloistered in the English department supply closet at the high school isn't exactly the place one would expect an exorcism to be conducted. But this was a matter of life and death, spiritually speaking. Considerations of place, or appropriateness for that matter, were unimportant. We were soldiers of Christ, members of the priesthood of believers, and it was our duty to combat evil wherever we found it, or drummed it up. John, the boy of whom she spoke, was between us. In my prayerful pose, I felt each tiny particle of grit being crushed into the skin of my knees by the hard, cold tile floor. I was 17, and this being my first exorcism, I was unsure what I was supposed to be doing. What was about to happen? I didn't know, so I kept silent. Again, she began calling for the demons possessing John to come out, name themselves, their number, and their leader. Nothing happened. John just sat there with a blank look on his face. I kept thinking about my knees, wishing I had something cushy to kneel on. And I sure hoped today's Jeopardy was a rerun. Mrs. Pascal continued her liturgy. Still nothing happened. She droned on. And then I heard a strange sound. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Was that Mrs. Pascal? Or was it a demon emerging from John? I looked over to find out. Holy crap, Mrs. Pascal is speaking in tongues. Growing up Methodist, we didn't so much do tongues. So this was new for me. Regardless, I knew if one got the gift of tongues, it was serious business. It was time to quit thinking about my stupid knees, put Jeopardy out of my mind, and get with the program. We had a soul to save. Not even prayers in the language of heaven coaxed the demons out. But Mrs. Pascal continued her chanting, flip-flopping back and forth between angel speak and English, bellowing each command with more fervor than the last. She was like a hound on a coon hunt, determined and not given up. She bayed in righteous tones her unintelligible incantations. She was not letting her quarry get away. More time passed. My mind began to wonder. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this. This isn't how it works in the movies. Maybe he really isn't possessed. I don't think it's working. Oh, shut up, what do you know? I had just become a Christian the year before, and after all, I was only a teenager. I reminded myself, Mrs. Pascal was the expert. She'd done this before. She was our teacher. She'd been a Christian for a long, long time. She knew the word. What's more, she'd been given a word of knowledge by the Holy Spirit. He told her John was in trouble. John wasn't like the rest of us. He had longish hair, he wore strange clothes, weird shoes and concert t-shirts with questionable graphics. Some might say they were of a satanic nature, definitely not very preppy. He listened to alternative music. He didn't go to church, any church. And worse yet, he was kind of a loner and seemed a little sad. Given all the facts, I surmised, with the help of Mrs. Pascal, he must be possessed by Satan. Somehow, that actually seemed logical. Poor John. There he sat enduring as Mrs. Pascal continued her recitations, naming and proclaiming her position as a child of Christ, her power as one bathed in the blood of Jesus, and by God, those demons had better respond. My thoughts kept flitting around, thinking about the gravity of the situation at hand, wondering if I was on schedule to work tomorrow afternoon. Did I have any homework? Was Mama cooking supper? And where are the demons? Jeopardy was long since over when John began to mumble. I figure he was thinking, if I ever want to go home, I better have some demons come out of me. His mumble got louder and evolved to speech. And with a voice just like a demon should sound, he spoke. You are pathetic. He is mine. I was getting a little freaked out and losing stamina for this adventure. Mrs. Pascal, undaunted, spoke to the demon. Name yourself. By the power of the resurrection, I command you to name yourself. And how many you command? John's demon responded with a wicked laugh and said, I am Gorbon, and I will destroy him, and you. I have 20,000 under me. You and your Christ can do nothing about it. I was on the verge of wetting my pants. My active imagination had convinced my more rational self, any minute now, Gorbon was going to reach over, break my neck, or worse, jump into me. I wanted to get the hell out of Dodge. Cautiously, I stood up, my hands grappling for the shelves at my back, as if I might become smaller and less noticeable if I could just be a little closer to the wall. With timidity, I asked Mrs. Pascal, what should we do? As I asked her, I was thinking, we should leave. John's a lost cause, and I don't want to be killed, maimed, or possessed by Gorbon and his minions. I knew what I wanted to do. My thoughts betrayed me. Mrs. Pascal gave me a look I can still see today. In an instant, I felt her disappointment. She knew I was weak. She knew I was going to fail her. She knew I was going to let God down, and worse, she knew exactly what I was. I felt her power and manipulation as she said in a cold, steely voice, "Don't leave me now. Get on your knees and pray." I obeyed Mrs. Pascal, though I was afraid of everything in my life crashing down all at once. I was afraid for John. Was he going to burn in hell if I didn't do this right? Did I make this happen to him because of my secret sin? Was God punishing me by letting John be destroyed by Satan? Nothing happened between us, nothing. It's just a crush, an unspoken crush. No one knew. Why was this happening? Why couldn't I just be normal? My mind was racing, but I was praying so hard I no longer felt the ache in my knees. I was sweating and my heart was pounding nearly out of my chest. This had to work. I stood up. Mrs. Pascal told me I had to take over because she was tiring. I knew I must get the demons out of John, and so I began. I mimicked, parroted, feigned power. I was desperate to make it work. It was up to me to save John from eternal damnation, and it seemed somehow it was the only hope I had of saving myself. Honestly, I don't remember much about that part of the exorcism, except that it ended soon thereafter. Gorbon took his leave. John was no longer possessed. He went home. After John left, Mrs. Pascal began to review the proceedings with me. I didn't really care anymore. Aware of my disinterest, she excused me, but not before admonishing me that this was just between us, and not to tell anyone, not even the Milburns, a surrogate family to me. I turned away from her and began walking down the long hallway toward the front doors of the school. From behind, I heard Mrs. Pascal say, "Remember, Brian, one day, all of your idols will fall." Confused and defeated, I continued walking, and then I began to cry. I was overwhelmed, a wreck. The worst part? Deep down, I knew that during that exorcism, my entire belief system had been on the chopping block. Some weeks later, Mrs. Pascal arranged a prayer meeting in her home. A friend picked me up, and off we went to her house. When we arrived, everyone was in the basement chatting. Not long after, aided by my sixth sense, I became aware that it was I who was the object of this meeting. I knew I was in trouble and had to get out. Nonchalantly, I excused myself to the restroom, which was upstairs. I called Mrs. Milburn, asked her to come get me. I left. I haven't spoken to Mrs. Pascal since. John and I are Facebook friends. We've seen each other a few times in the intervening 20 or so years, but we've never spoken about the event. For years, I was embarrassed about my involvement in this exorcism. Then one day it hit me. I was a child. At 40, it's clear, the demons live neither in John nor in me.
Brian Irwin resides in his hometown of Russellville, Arkansas, where he runs a custom frame shop. He is the youngest of seven and is a proud papa to his four-legged child, Ricky. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Timonos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Black Baptist Church, amen. I know sin by his first name. I know salvation well. You can say I saw the light in flickering flames of hell. I got a bottle of redemption on my shelf. Child, let me help you save yourself. He's too drunk to stay, and my angels got their hands full. I help the only way I can. I got a bottle of redemption on my shelf. Child, let me help you help yourself. Good God Almighty, we're glory bound, and there's plenty of redemption to go around. Whether it's a one-room tavern bar stool or a little white church house pew, I find the faith to fight the way my Jesus wants me to.